Hi, I'm Andor Scottness. I teach history here at Russell Sage College. Our topic tonight is learning from Latin American workers, the working men and women of Mexico, both indigenous and mestizo, have a long and a rich history of struggle, of resistance, of rebellion, and of revolution. This is a rich history from which we can all learn. In fact, it's a history the world can learn from. Our next speaker, Dr. Susan Gauss, will be speaking about the working people of Mexico. Her topic is the world of Mexican workers from a historical perspective. Susan is professor of history and of Latin American and Caribbean studies at the University at Albany. She teaches broadly on Latin America, but her own focus in terms of her research is gender and labor in Mexico. So I want to introduce now Susan Gauss, the world of Mexican workers from a historical perspective. Susan.
Thank you. And thank you to the organizers for inviting me here tonight. It's a great honor for me to be here, so to the workers. In November 1914, Mexican anarchist Ricardo Flores Magón issued his manifesto to the workers of the world. Speaking from exile in the United States, he presciently argued that, quote, the fight of the wage slave had no frontiers, end quote, and warned that if Mexican workers lost the revolution of 1910 to 1917, Mexico, quote, would become an ideal land for business because of low salaries, and American workers would find their firms and factories there instead of in the United States because it would be more profitable to employ Mexicans, end quote. The workers that Flores Magón had done so much to inspire before he was forced into exile fortunately did win the revolution. Yet today they continue to battle against low wages and exploitation, now in the face of new forces associated with neoliberalism and globalization. My goal this evening is to examine Mexico's radical labor history in order to provide some clues about why Mexico's workers apparently won the revolution, yet continue to struggle for social justice. In 1917, during the closing moments of the revolution, Mexico's new ruling elites wrote a constitution that incorporated one of the most progressive labor codes in the world at the time. Still in force today, Article 123 of the Constitution included provisions for things like the 8-hour day, for a minimum wage, for overtime pay, for things we're still looking for today, like maternity leave at full wages, and quite incredibly at the time, equal pay for equal work regardless of sex. Article 123 also included a provision stating, quote, workers shall have the right to organize for the defense of their respective interests by forming unions, end quote. And spurred by this legislation and by the radical fervor of the recently ended revolution, the 1920s really was an effervescent period in the Mexican labor movement. As communists, as anarcho-syndicalists, as Catholics, owners, and even the state itself fought to organize Mexico's workers. So successful were the communists in these early days that with the support of the industrial workers of the world, it was at this time that they formed the Mexican section of the Wobblies as well as the Mexican Communist Party. So by the 1930s, there were four major labor organizations that were struggling for control of the Mexican working class. So intense was the conflict over labor that in some cases, workers even took to carrying pistols to work in order to struggle for control of the factory, and violence and even murder were really all too common outcomes of some of the labor strife during the 1920s and 1930s and even into the 1940s. In 1931, in an effort to overcome this labor strife while breaking the communist hold over labor, the state instituted a labor code aimed at codifying that Article 123 of the 1917 Constitution. These conflicts over labor organizing, as well as the 1931 federal labor law, reflected one of the most enduring tensions in Mexico in the 20th century, that of the power of the state to intervene in labor affairs. The most lasting legacy of the 1931 code was that it established the state as the mediator between labor and capital. Importantly, while the 1931 labor code supplemented repression in the state's efforts to suppress labor radicals, it also provided the legal framework for workers to demand their full constitutionally guaranteed rights. And in the 1930s, in the hands of populist President Lázaro Cárdenas, It did exactly that. In those years, the Federal Labor Code provided the foundation for extensive reforms that, according to one scholar, Arturo Anguiano, ended the owner's, quote, anachronistic practice of exploiting workers to the point of exhaustion, end quote. In exchange, many workers gave up their independence and joined the state-allied Confederation of Mexican Workers, or what we know as the CTM. In the 1930s, the attendant benefits, including wage increases and a shift in shop floor control from owners to workers, really outweighed the losses of independence. Yet the demobilization of the 1930s would ultimately prove detrimental to the labor movement, and according to many scholars, really provided the foundation for the betrayal of the revolution beginning in the 1940s. Even the Mexican Communist Party had abandoned its more revolutionary position by the 1930s and 1940s, and communist unions even often affiliated with the state-allied CTM. And in doing so, they were really taking their cue from U.S. communists who were in line with Stalin's calls for appeasement with democratic capitalism in an effort to forestall the spread of fascism. And of course, I have to mention at this point that the most well-known opponent of this policy, Leon Trotsky, ultimately received asylum in Mexico, as well as met his fate there in 1940 at the end of an ice pick. In the 1940s, the state began the process of marginalizing communist unions from mainstream labor politics. In 1948, the ruling party, what we commonly know as the PRI, initiated the process of dismantling and rebuilding Mexico's remaining communist-dominated unions, including the powerful railway, oil, and mining unions. Using legislation, repression, and Cold War propaganda, the PRI replaced the leadership of these unions with its own cronies. And this period is known as the Charrazo, for the pension of the newly installed railway leader for charrería, or cowboy culture, and dressing in the traditional cowboy style, which he was particularly fond of. Nevertheless, the Charrazo destroyed the left's position within the mainstream labor movement. And the CTM, with the PRI's assistance, at this point consolidated its hold over national labor. Since the 1940s, the state-allied CTM has continued to dominate labor in Mexico. The organization has been marked by what's called continuismo, or the practice of leaders perpetuating themselves in power, often for decades. Old guard CTM labor leaders, colloquially referred to as dinosaurs, drew closer to both owners and the state through the 20th century, and due to bribery and corruption, have really become a wealthy elite in their own right, as attested to by the vacation homes and luxury autos that many of them own. Their defense of the working class has been tepid. In actuality, the CTM labor leaders themselves have often been forces behind production speed-ups and the repression of strikes in the 20th century. Their main task has really been to deliver the vote for the PRI at election time. The independent labor movement, as a result, has really struggled to survive through the 20th century. For much of the 1950s and the 1960s, the inducements for workers to join in the PRI's project were high. Drawn by these new industrial jobs that were exploding amid the Mexican miracle of the 1950s and 1960s, this period when Mexico was seeing average annual growth rates of about 6.5%, rural migrants fled from the countryside into the cities in search of urban opportunities. During that period, Mexico was transformed into an urban industrial country. Now, roughly 3/4 of the population is urban, with about 1/4 of the population living in the world's second largest metropolitan area, Mexico City. And Mexico is currently ranked as the world's 12th largest economy, ahead of countries like South Korea and on par with countries like Canada. Industry accounts for an impressive 27% of its gross domestic product. And to give you a perspective on that, industry accounts for about 21% of the United States' gross domestic product. So it's a highly industrialized country. For Mexico's industrial workers, the 1950s and 1960s were a heady time as real wages rose steadily. More importantly, as historian Steve Batchelor describes the impact of this transformation on Mexico's population, quote, "For these new industrial workers, the factory became a cauldron where laborers fashioned a new political consciousness and social identity. One-time campesinos and rural dwellers took great pride in being at the forefront of national progress and modernization." One auto worker declared, "I took real pride in saying I worked for General Motors. I was helping industrialize my country." Along with these remarkable gains, however, came problems. Population growth that steadily outstripped job growth meant that poverty remained endemic. While overall most Mexicans enjoyed higher standards of living during this time, the income disparity between rich and poor exploded during the Mexican miracle. As the benefits of the miracle disproportionately accrued at the top, workers increasingly became disillusioned with the leaders of the CTM and their rigid alliance with the ruling party. As one auto worker pondered, quote, "How can these men who accept bribes from the company be expected to defend workers?" end quote. The earliest manifestation that labor radicalism survived the purges of the late 1940s came in 1958, when an upstart militant group in the railway union ousted the pre-backed leadership. Facing dissent that was spreading to the teachers, telephone, and oil workers' unions, the pre conceded an array of workers' demands. The mobilizations continued unabated. Scholars really consider the aftermath of this event to be the first indication of the problems with the Mexican miracle, including the lengths to which the PRI was willing to go in order to subdue its opposition. In March 1959, the PRI struck, meeting the railway workers with repression. A handful of workers were killed, over 3,000 workers were arrested, about 20,000 workers lost their jobs. In the end, about 500 workers were tried for a variety of offenses, and the strike's leaders received sentences ranging from 11 to 16 years in jail. Along with repression, the PRI continued to use the 1931 labor code to control labor during the 1950s and 1960s. In these decades, few independent unions were able to attain the legal recognition required by Mexican labor law that would have allowed them to go to national labor courts to lobby on behalf of their workers. The year 1968 really cast new light on the marginalization and repression of independent organizing. In 1968, in an effort to demonstrate to the world the economic successes of the Mexican miracle, Mexico decided to host the Olympics. The lavish buildings, the lavish sports arenas really could do little to hide the fact that most Mexicans continued to live in wretched poverty. During the summer of 1968, working class and middle class students began to demonstrate in defense of democracy, demanding democracy from the PRI and free elections. As the start of the Olympics neared, the ruling party leaders decided to use repression to subdue the growing demonstrations before international attention was focused on Mexico. The massacre that followed accomplished this task, but at great cost to the legitimacy of the PRI. So in the face of the erosion of its legitimacy after 1968, the PRI was forced to actually begin to concede to a wave of breakaway union movements in the 1970s. Radicalized by the failures of the Mexican miracle and the experience of 1968, however, these new movements now included demands for democracy and union autonomy. By the mid-1970s, over 100 independent unions had formed, including in textiles, the metal, rubber, and auto industries, and in food processing. Between November 1975 and July 1976, this organizing translated into a serious threat to the regime, as electrical workers led a series of protests against corruption and the PRI's particular brand of what scholars call authoritarian democracy. They were joined by hundreds of thousands of auto workers, metal workers, telephone workers, and university workers, as well as by students and peasants. Unable to subdue the spreading dissent through negotiations, on July 16, 1976, the PRI ordered hired thugs and army units to occupy important electrical plants. Thousands of workers were summarily fired and replaced, and the movement was crushed. This really put a temporary hush over independent union organizing during the late 1970s and into the 1980s. But even more devastating for the labor movement has been the economic turmoil that has crippled the Mexican economy since the 1980s. By the early 1980s, the Mexican miracle had given way to a lost decade, this 10-year period when Mexico experienced little or no economic growth. The austerity measures that were imposed on Mexico by the International Monetary Fund as a condition for receiving loans really reversed any of the gains that Mexico's workers had made during the 1950s and the 1960s. By 1986, over two-thirds of urban households in Mexico were living below the poverty line. By 1988, the minimum wage was worth only half of its 1981 value. By 1992, it had dropped to 37%. While non-wage benefits such as subsidized transport, health, housing, and food declined. As political scientist Judith Adler-Hellman, from whom I took the previous statistics, as she states in her book, Mexican Lives, poor Mexicans had never counted on receiving a fair share of the national income, but at least they previously could count on riding public transportation and buying a stack of tortillas for a few pennies. By the early 1990s, even these basic necessities were out of the reach of many Mexicans. So this economic disarray of the past 25 years has really provided a fresh climate for the penetration of Mexico by foreign investment, as companies have flooded into Mexico to take advantage of neoliberal policies and a workforce that's weakened by economic depression and decades of corruption and repression. For example, in 1987, Ford Motors Company fired all of its workers at its plant in Cuautitlan. Workers there previously had actually managed to attain relatively high wages and control over the shop floor in comparison to other Ford plants in Mexico. Immediately after the mass firing, the company rehired all of the original workers under a new contract that enhanced the authority of corrupt union leaders. Workers' wages dropped overnight. When the workers tried to affiliate with another national labor federation, the CTM violently intervened in the union and prevented it. In fairness, I should add that the CTM's backing of the PRI hasn't been completely consistent in recent decades. Indeed, so inflamed was the CTM at the drop in real wages in the 1980s that in 1983 it actually invited independent unions to join in its official annual May Day parade, which normally is dominated by the official labor movement in Mexico. And they did this in order to try to send a message to the PRI. But really, the CTM has mostly towed the party line in the past few decades, really acting more as a branch of business in the state than as a branch of labor. Along with other official labor organizations, it has facilitated workforce downsizing, wage limits, and industrial restructuring, all of which the PRI has pursued in order to prime the workforce for the privatization of state-owned companies and the expansion of owner authority over labor. In essence, the PRI has reorganized and weakened unions in order to clear the way for foreign investment. Those workers who have challenged the state's control of unions and the effects of neoliberalism have been met with repression, including petroleum workers in 1989 and Ford auto workers in 1990. And the case of the petroleum workers really is especially devastating. Though its leaders were largely corrupt, it was one of the few unions whose leaders had really stood tough in a certain way in the face of the PRI in the 20th century, and its workers were among the best paid in Mexico in the late 1980s. After the government's repression in 1989, the union's leaders were replaced by state-imposed leaders. The government asserted that in dismantling the union, it was merely trying to prosecute the union's leaders for criminal activities, including murder and gun smuggling. But as one oil worker stated in the aftermath, quote, "The blow that struck down the leaders was not only a blow at them and their interests, but rather at the entire oil workers' union." This sort of repression continues today, as in the case of recent government efforts to oust the leader of the mine workers' union, who it accuses of corruption, and to replace him with a government ally. All over Mexico, mine workers have walked off the job in protest. In response, the government has initiated a series of crackdowns, highlighted by the videotaped killing of two striking workers by police trying to break a strike at a major steel mill just last week. Nevertheless, this past Friday, 3 days ago, 200,000 miners and foundry workers walked off the job to protest this repression. And just today, in reading today's papers, for the first time since in addition to the official May Day parade, independent unions also formed their own May Day parade. For the first time ever since the independent unions started their annual May Day parade, the official unions are joining in their May Day, some of the official unions, I should state, are joining in their May Day celebration in order to protest this repression and to demand respect for union autonomy. I don't know how large the demonstrations are. As I was reading about it, it was running in the tens of thousands up towards 100,000. Preparing the Mexican workforce for NAFTA was a key goal of the PRI in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The companies that have flooded into Mexico in the past 12 years have done little to relieve the country's economic problems. Maquila jobs have little security, and workers often labor under conditions that don't even meet minimum federal labor standards. And labor inspectors generally close their eyes to the wide array of abuses in an effort to create a climate conducive to foreign investment. And the unions, as one worker simply stated, quote, "The union can't protect us," end quote. The labor laws that seemed so promising in the 1930s continue to be eschewed in favor of protecting owners, both Mexican and foreign, in the interests of economic growth. And President Vicente Fox himself seems intent on ensuring that Mexico's competitive advantage should remain its cheap labor. Echoing the concerns of Mexican anarchist Ricardo Flores Magón, who I started this talk with, one labor organizer in Matamoros exclaimed, quote, "Americans say they can save us from starvation, but all of us who have come to the border, if we had stayed where we were, we would not be dying of hunger. Here on the border, we are just slaves," end quote. Living amid the massive levels of chemicals produced by companies such as General Motors and subsidiaries of DuPont, which along with disease have led to high rates of cancer, miscarriage, and birth defects along the border, workers cling with fading hope that a maquila job will somehow lift their families out of poverty. At the same time, some of the most vibrant organizing is currently taking place along the U.S.-Mexico border. Workers and community organizers are joining to protest the environmental and human degradation that is a hallmark of border cities such as Reynoso and Brownsville. Importantly, some of these organizations are crossing the very national borders that Flores Magón insinuated had to be overcome if workers were to challenge the exploitation attending the expansion of global capitalism. These organizations, such as organizations that promote solidarity with grassroots groups in Mexico, Central America, and Asia, are currently in the vanguard of struggles for workers' rights. And like recent demonstrations here in California and Texas, as well as today's boycott, which have been led by migrants whose livelihood and identity are deeply rooted both in Mexico and in the United States, the border organizing is fueled by the rich past of political engagement and public demonstration by Mexico's workers. These organizations along the border and demonstrations in the United States are certainly driven by current conditions of poverty. Yet the legacy of the Mexican Revolution and its radical aftermath are also critical in explaining workers' continued expectations for social justice, as well as their continued willingness to act to end exploitation. Thank you.